the line drops that go from the pole pick transformer on the telephone pole, on the utility pole in the street, over to the weatherhead of the house. Almost all of these, those lately are aluminum wiring. And so I guess they've got some very good ways of installing those connectors on each end, because I'm hearing very few complaints about that. Although I take it back. Let me think now. Roughly around 1975, I had the so-called dim-bright problem. In other words, the 220 wiring from the pole pick transformer to the house. Let me drop. You've got what I call the red wire and the black wire, which have 240 volts, 230 volts across them, and the center tap, which is really a ground lead, and you've got 110 volts, 120 volts each side of center tap. Because that ground lead, the third wire coming from the street to my weatherhead of my house, was making intermittent contact, I was running into the dim-bright problem. In other words, very rarely do you have exactly the same amount of loading on the red side, 110-volt wiring of the house, versus the black side, 110-volt wiring of the house. As such, almost always there's a certain amount of neutral current that flows back to that pole pick transformer. As such, when that starts making intermittent contact, some of the house is going to get more than 120 volts, and the other part of the house is going to get less than 120 volts. That's why they call it the dim-bright problem. So I was seeing a flickering of my lighting. I reported it to a Long Island lighting company, as they were called in those days, Lightner as they call it today, and they pretty rapidly came and reestablished that connector. And so, to my knowledge, yeah, they didn't replace the wiring. They just replaced the connector. So even that super good connector on that aluminum wiring can give you some grief. So it's something to look out for. John, what do you recommend in all this? And are you using Nolux on your aluminum fixtures, if you have any? That's one of the many brands of this juice that you put in there that avoids oxidation to aluminum contacts. KC2WGB, K2LAW.net.
Comment when John is done.
You've got to be that John first. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. One other comment. You were right on there. It's not the screws that come loose. Aluminum wire has a property called flow, much more than copper. When it's put under compression, we learned it in industry, and in heavy wiring, we had those same fires in industry on 400 amp, 600 amp lines because of flow problems. As it flowed, the pressure connector lost contact, and that's what started the problem. And they've never resolved that, although they do have high press fittings and, as you said, those surface connectors coming down from your drop, all three wires are aluminum. They will not put up copper anymore. And they use high press on that. And they last quite a few years. But, of course, there's no question of fire there. It's on the outside. But in the home, under no circumstances should you allow aluminum wiring in your house. I don't care what kind of chemical or what kind of compression fittings you put on there. It's not like copper. Copper flows a lot less, and that's where the loose screws came from. KC2WGB.
Very fine, John. When it comes to something taking a change in shape versus pressure, in the case of Teflon, they call it cold flow. Probably they don't use that word when it comes to aluminum, but cold flow, or it slowly changes in shape, and unless your connector has got a lot of springy compliance to it, to adapt to that change in thickness, you're going to develop an intermittent contact. I'm also amazed at the number of things in my house, like the thermostat on the refrigerator and the thermostat on the oven. When you really study the way they work inside, as the temperature slowly comes up to or down to the right temperature, the contacts very slowly separate, which means it's going to be arcing and sparking. I'm a little bit amazed that some of those designs don't have a real click function to them. A micro switch, if you study the inside of a micro switch, it really has a click function, and it can give you a partial contact. But many of these thermostats do. And so that's something to look forward to as far as a better design. Look for ways of getting around that. Go right ahead, Vito.
That's one of the things that I see all the time. What happens is these are bug nuts, BUG bug nuts. They are designed for different gauge wires depending on the ampacity of the wires, the circular area of the wires, I should say, from the transformer to the pole to the weatherhead. Another thing too, you can have number 10 wire or number 8 wire or even number 6 wire out there and operating a 240 volt, 200 amp service in your building. The reason being because it's free air, and the conductors can be thinner, and you have to do the same function. Of course, if you had an old house with an old 60 amp service, of course, that has to be replaced. Let me drop for a second. The thing you already mentioned about you had a name for it with lights bright on one side and lesser on the other. The ground wire you had made mention is becomes the neutral wire as it goes into the fuse panel. There's a reason for a neutral wire. It's like a seesaw, let's use that language, between phase A and phase B. And what it does is like a mediator. It keeps them in check. If the one only neutral wire at all, you have phase A could be at 55 or 60 volts in that range, I'm just guessing, 90 volts, where the light in your home will be dim in one phase, and it could be 160 volts on the other phase where the lights would burn out. So what happens is this neutral lake keeps phase A and B in check and keeps them in balance. So they're both just about the same voltage. But that's the reason for that neutral, and there's where that problem was coming in, as you mentioned. If the neutral or the ground neutral combination lake had a problem of some nature, let me drop. Then you can see what I'm saying is true, that one phase would gain voltage, one would drop in voltage. So that's why the neutral is most important. Okay? One thing of many other items associated with panels and sub-panels. We can get another big lengthy conversation about that too, about ground wires. The ground wire is called the ground E-I-N-G, and the neutral is called the ground egg E-D. It serves a different function, but they're both very important in the operation of circuit panels. So back to you.
Thank you for the additional information, Vito. Some people don't know it, but the pulpit transformer for conventional, for 90-some-odd% of Long Island homes for sure, we call it two-phase. It really is one phase. There's one single phase, a secondary winding of that pulpit transformer that takes your 13.2 kilovolts, in some cases, down to the wiring to your house. It really is, in most cases, a 240-volt winding with center tap. So 240 volts across the whole winding with center tap, 120 volts each side of center tap. Those three wires are brought into your house, and many of us conventionally call it phase A and phase B. I sometimes call it the red wire and the black wire. It really is one phase. Or you could say that the two are 180 degrees out of phase. But in the case of two-phase and three-phase wiring by the New York City standards, for instance, many places in Queens, for instance, where Rich lives, N2EO, and many places in Richmond, in other words, Staten Island, really have three-phase wiring, and two of those three phases come into the house. And now what you and I call 240 on Long Island is really 208, because of 120 degree phase difference between them two phases compared to the 180 degrees I get with my two phases. So there's lots of ambiguity here with the so-called phases and the way things are wired. One further comment, let me drop. And that is the particular telephone pole or utility pole out in front of my house for a whole lot of years got hit almost every year. It had to be replaced. It was an automobile because it's near a curve in the road. My mailbox used to be hit all the time until I put a swinging mechanism strikes my mailbox, it swings out of the way and it swings back. I used to have to dig a new post and put a new mailbox every, almost every year. But because the telephone pole needs replacement so often, occasionally they forget to replace the ground wire. There's a great big copper plate that goes on the bottom of the utility pole before they install it in the ground. They call it the butt plate. And that, there's a piece of 6-gauge wire that goes from it up to the grounding of the pole plate transformer. When that wire is missing, the grounding of that transformer is picked up by the individual houses. A dangerous condition. And if you put a clamp-on ammeter on the so-called ground lead in your house, you put a clamp-on ammeter into the water pipe system, which maybe is your ground, and if you sense current flowing through it, it indicates something ain't good. And there was an automobile accident across the house from me, and because of the lack of grounding of that proper pole plate transformer, the 13.2 kilovolts went roaring as raw voltage straight through that weatherhead of the house into the house wiring and created a fire in the basement on the fuse panel. So you'd be amazed how many people are running with a dangerous system where that grounding right at the utility pole is not taking place. So there's something to worry about. I think that we've answered all the questions of the people who signed in earlier. If not, they're going to speak up right now. And if not, I'm going to go over to John. KC2WGB is going to go to John's mailbag. It used to be called Bell's.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
In the old days, it used to be called Bell's mailbag. So let me go over to John. Give a little bit of delay, John, to make sure I haven't skipped somebody. KC2WGB with a little bit of delay. KQRAW, the drink man.
KC2WGB, can you repeat that? Everyone on the net. All right. Got a nice question for you today. Yesterday we covered, you had mentioned a halo antenna, and I have a question on that. Ken was looking to build one, so let me let it drop. Okay. Halo antenna for 2 meters and 440. He wants to know if it's possible. Can he mount two rings on one mast and how far apart they should be? And are they quarter wave, half wave? He doesn't know much about halo. And he's read some in the amateur handbook, but he's not sure on how to go about the construction. So maybe you could answer some of those questions and give him a few tips. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, one of the things that's not very well understood is that when you're stacking various antennas that are on different bands, I might be stacking a 6-meter Yagi, a 2-meter Yagi, a 432 Yagi, and you could take the naive approach, the super conservative approach of calculating the effective capture area, which really is a circle, even though your eye doesn't see it. There's a circle in space that the RF energy gets sucked into and eventually goes down the feed line of the antenna. And you could look at the individual effective areas of each antenna and stack them in such a way that the areas don't touch each other. Good conservative approach. Lots and lots of guys have done that. You don't have to do that. If I'm stacking a 6, a 2, and a 432, the only thing that happens if I stack them too close is that eventually the 2-meter elements are so close to some of the 6-meter elements that the extra capacitance that the tips of the 2-meter element C tunes the 2-meter elements to a lower frequency. That happens at about a 1 foot, 1.5 foot spacing. And there's a similar spacing like that for the 432 coming to the 2-meter antenna. So when the antennas are on different bands, you can stack them as close as you like in many cases. There used to be something called the Senko 6 and 2-meter antenna. It literally was one boom with 6-meter elements, and in between the 6-meter elements, there were 2-meter elements. And the extra capacitance on the 2-meter elements being close to the 6-meter elements were retuned accordingly, made a little bit shorter, brought it back into resonance, and it worked like a charm. So that's so-called Senko 6 and 2, popular in the early 1960 time frame, literally was two antennas. pilots on those two bands with 0 feet of stacking, vertical stacking distance. Let me drop. And what's going on in that case is that there is an effective capture area of each of those antennas, but only on the appropriate frequency. If I feed 432 meg energy into a 2 meter antenna, even though there's a 3-to-1 frequency relationship, all of those directors are the wrong length, the wrong spacing, and all of that Yagi-like function disappears. There's nothing there but a dipole, if you know what I mean. And so the effective area of a 2 meter antenna, when fed with 432 energy, or vice versa, the effective area goes to near zero, something very small. Therefore, very close stacking distances can be done. In the case of a pair of halos, I am reasonably convinced that you can put each of the two halos on the two different bands, one inside of the other. The smaller halo will experience a little bit of detuning because of the nearby larger halo, but that's something you can very easily compensate for. The larger halo will not even see the smaller halo, so they can literally be stacked coplanar, if you know what I mean. Now, what the halo itself is, I could take, if I wanted to, a true half-wave dipole and start bending it into a circle. And if I did that, as the tips of the dipole come closer and closer together, as I make it into a circle, extra capacitance is sensed out there, and I'd have to make the dipole a little bit shorter. And if I did that, I would have a pattern which is not truly omnidirectional. The peak of the pattern you had before you bent the dipole into the circle, you would still have that peak in that direction. In the side direction, you would have a heck of a lot less energy, and that's because the current flowing along the loop is a lot larger in the center, and it goes to near zero at the tips. If you make the dipole shorter in diameter,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
As you make the dipole, by the way, a cubical quad antenna is a one wavelength antenna. That's a very different antenna than a halo, than a hula hoop. A one wavelength cubical quad driven element really is two vertically stacked halfway dipoles, one above the other. You know, the upper one has got the ends bent down, the lower one has got the ends bent up, and they happen to be connected together at the right and left-hand side for a horizontally polarized. So a one-wavelength square loop, very different antenna. And you simply mount one of those coplanar with the ground, you don't get an omnidirectional pattern. You only get an omnidirectional pattern out of a loop-like antenna if the loop is considerably shorter than half-wavelength in length, in circumference. As you make it less and less than a quarter wavelength, than a half wavelength in circumference, you get a more and more omnidirectional pattern. In other words, same amount of energy to each one of the azimuthal directions. That's the good news. The bad news is you need a loading capacitor at the end to bring it back into resonance. So if you look at a hula hoop 6 meter antenna, it usually has three rings on top of each other to be mechanically strong and a little bit more bandwidth out of it. And there was a significant loading capacitor at the end. And I'm guessing that a 6 meter halo probably had not a half wave of circumference. I'm guessing it had something like a quarter wave or a little bit less in circumference to try to make it more omnidirectional. And as I said, that great big loading capacitor at the end. And so you can choose a length of circular loop antenna that's convenient for you. Quarter wavelength is a good starting point, in my opinion. There's also, when it comes to loop antennas, there's a particular chapter in the Antenna Engineering Handbook that gives you a lot more information. Let me drop. So, bringing it back into resonance by the loading capacitor, because it's considerably shorter than a half wave in circumference, that's relatively easy to do. To properly impedance match it to the 50 ohm transmission line, there's at least two approaches that people use to do that. One is a structure that looks like a gamma rod, and that does a very good job. The other is another internal loop where you carefully set the diameter of that loop, and sometimes it has a tuning capacitor on it. So whether you feed the halo by way of another smaller loop inside or by way of a gamma matching rod where you're about to start stacking two loops on two different bands inside of each other, probably the gamma matching rod is the right way to do it. When you properly use a gamma matching rod, it really has a series capacitor and a length to it. You choose the right length and the right series capacitor, which is usually done by a telescoping structure. You can, with a little bit of tuning, make it a perfect 50-ohm match at your particular frequency. Let me drop. And bear in mind that a small, quarter wave total circumference, quarter wave circumference loop antenna will be narrowband. You tune one for, let me pick a number, 50.1 megacycles. When you go down to 50.0 or 52, one megacycle away, I'm not sure of the exact number, but I'll bet you it'll easily go to 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. It's got a rather narrow bandwidth to it. A real half-wave dipole has got some nice bandwidth. When you shorten it and make it into a loop structure, the bandwidth goes down pretty fast. So that's something you have to get used to. And don't expect to build a loop antenna that's going to cover all of 2 meters or all of 432 or all of 6 meters. If your definition of covering is better than a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, without using some other techniques, it's not going to do it. So this is some of the information on loop antennas. You can easily build them out of copper tubing, aluminum tubing. Be careful how you do the aluminum tubing. But many of us make a driven element on our Yagis out of aluminum tubing. And you got to worry a little bit about dissimilar metals. If that strap you make to couple the end of the gamma match rod onto the loop happens to be made out of copper, and the loop itself is made out of aluminum, you then have a copper-aluminum dissimilar metal interface. Within the weather, out in the weather, that's going to give you corrosion and a problem. And so, one simple solution to that I found, which is not common sense, let me drop. Is that if you decided to use a copper strap to make that attachment, if you simply tin the copper with solder, believe it or not, aluminum and solder are not considered dissimilar. Solder and copper are not considered dissimilar. So by simply tinning it with copper and with solder, the problem goes away. I had a homebrew 6-meter Yagi a whole lot of years ago where I did have a copper strap in there, and each time I transmitted, I got a different voltage as the corrosion broke through, if you know what I mean, voltage-wise broke through, until I realized what was going on, did cover it with solder after cleaning it all up, and the problem went away. So these are some of the hints. The exact diameter of the antenna, to some degree, doesn't matter. By way of the loading capacitor at the end, you can always force it into resonance. By way of the gamma match rod, if that's the method of feeding it you use, by proper tuning of the gamma match rod, you can always make it a 50-ohm antenna. So the exact diameter you start out with is a lot less critical than first meets common sense. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, good information, Dick. One final question on this halo. He's thinking of using this on his mobile. So now he wants to know, is there any difference, and if there is a difference in the pattern, he'd like to have the circumference vertical instead of horizontal or parallel to the Earth. What do you think of that?
The usual arrangement of a hula hoop antenna is the loop itself is parallel to the Earth and gives you a antenna pattern that's both horizontally polarized and somewhat omnidirectional. It favors, if you set it up with the capacitor at the 12 o'clock position, so to speak, when you're looking at a top view, it tends to favor the 6 to 12 o'clock direction as opposed to the 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock direction. It has a little bit of directivity to it, but it is horizontally polarized and almost omnidirectional. If you could see the full three-dimensional pattern of that, what would it look like? Somewhat like a donut pattern, somewhat like a pattern of a donut laying parallel to the ground. That would be approximately the pattern. However, you take that hula hoop and now stack it so that the plane of the loop perpendicular to the ground. It's the equivalent of taking that donut pattern that used to be parallel to the ground, and now you set the donut up on end. The good news is you've got vertical polarization. And if you set the donut, if you set the hula hoop up on end so that the plane of the loop is perpendicular to the ground and favors the forward aft direction, favors the longitudinal direction of the car, you'll be vertically polarized. You'll have a nice amount of signal directly forward, directly aft. You'll have the deepest null you can imagine to the left of the car and to the right of the car. At the 9 o'clock position and the 3 o'clock position, when you're viewing the car top view, there'll be a null in the pattern. So to make an omnidirectional, vertically polarized antenna, we usually do that with a whip, quarter wave or 5/8 wave whip. To set a hula hoop up vertically, I don't recommend it. As an experiment, it would be fun.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As an experiment, it would be fun, and if you're willing to put an antenna rotator on it, you can get some nice characteristics out of it. But it certainly will not be an omnidirectional antenna if you actually do that. So I don't recommend it, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech man.
KC2WGB. Okay, then, great information. I assume he wants it vertically mounted on the car to save room. Because he's going to have it off to one side. But he can always make an RDF unit out of it. That sounds good. Let me let it drop, and I'll go to the next one. Okay, a gentleman by the name of Espinosa. All right. He had heard our conversation, or your conversation, on the infinitesimal dipole, or antenna. And he has a question. He has a 75-foot length of coax, and if he puts a 75-ohm terminating resistor on the end, it satisfies the requirement of the 50 ohms, and it's good at all frequencies. Wonderful. Now he wants to know, why can't he use that as a radiator? Now he knows that you have claimed that the infinitesimal dipole, you can get, or antenna, that you can get as much as 97% of the efficiency back, although the Q is very critical. Maybe you could explain to him the difference between the absorption and radiant, who have it radiate. He's a little confused about that. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
With the information we've given him up to now, John, he should be confused. He only has half the story. If I make an infinitesimal dipole, and you can find out what's going to happen when you start making a dipole real short by looking at the so-called Brown and Woodward curve. By looking at, going to the website of WA2 MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha.org. You go to that website, you go to the bottom of the page, and you look at the K2LIW Yankee and dipole information. There you'll find the Brown and Woodward curve. Okay, you'll find out that as your monopole, the curves are all for monopoles, so therefore, when it comes to dipoles, you just take everything you read there and double it, both the resistive component and the reactive component, knowing that a dipole is a pair of monopoles back to back. If I make the monopole 90 degrees long, that's really half of the dipole, which would be 180 degrees long, you'll find out that the monopole has a resistive component of about 35 ohms. You double that and it's 70 ohms. So now you know that a dipole that has a full half wavelength electronically is going to have a resistive component of roughly 70 ohms and a reactive component of roughly zero. That's very desirable. As you start making the dipole slash monopole shorter and shorter, the resistive component rapidly goes towards zero. The reactive component starts going up to great big numbers of capacitive reactants. So, if I now make an infinitesimal dipole, let me pick a number out of the air. I make the dipole 5 degrees long instead of 90 degrees long. My guess is the resistive component is about 3 ohms, and the reactive component is probably 1,000 ohms of capacitive reactants. As a load on the end of a transmission line.
Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As a load on of the transmission line, that infinitesimal dipole is, let me pick a number out of the air, a 200 to 1 standing wave ratio. Pretty darn horrible. However, if I've got an antenna tuner that really has enough antenna tuning range, and in this case I've got it located very close to the end of the transmission line, very close to that antenna, because you run a piece of coax cable with that high a visual, you're going to get a mountain of loss on it. So I've got this real stealthy antenna tuner at the end of that cable feeding that infinitesimal dipole. It's going to be extremely narrow band, very high Q antenna, but I can bring it down to 50 ohms impedance with my antenna tuner. I can get 90 some odd percent efficiency out of it. Now let's find out what's happening. If I now study the way that dipole is being fed, I will discover that those two little tips of the dipole that are left probably has, with 1 watt of transmitting power, probably 3,000 volts on them. The voltage will go to huge numbers, and that's the way you feed a very small dipole that has a lot of capacitive reactance. When you impedance match it, at any reasonable amount of power, you're going to arc over the dipole. Very, very high voltage. That will eventually do all of the radiation for you in a dipole-like pattern with reasonable efficiency. Now, if I take a 50-ohm resistor with a reasonable length of leads on the end, and I hang it at the end of the coax cable, the good news, I can make it a 50-ohm or a 70-ohm resistor. The effect is the same. I'm getting a good termination on the cable. That's the good news. And because of the way I'm feeding it, yes, the leads coming out of the resistor going into the coax cable, they do look like the length of a nearly infinitesimal dipole. That's a little piece of good news. However, when I'm putting a watt of power down that cable, feeding that 50 or 70 ohm resistor, the voltage...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
When I do that, the voltage I'm putting on those leads is something extremely small. It's only a couple of volts, not thousands of volts, when I really feed an open-circuited infinitesimal dipole. So although physically it has some of the length, because of where the resistor is located, where the impedance is located, and the fact that I'm not now using a very stealthy antenna tuner to step up that voltage, to step up that impedance, I'm not feeding it in a way that makes it radiate well. However, you've got to be careful now. That 50-ohm or 70-ohm resistor hanging on the end of the coax cable, it is an antenna. It's not a bad antenna impedance match-wise. As far as gain is concerned as an antenna, it probably is 25 dB negative compared to a dipole. And as bad as that sounds, such an antenna is being used as we speak. It's called a Tallbaum antenna. If you take a look at the two antennas that are on the vertical stabilizer of an EA-6B aircraft, on the left-hand side of the vertical stabilizer is a horizontal dipole, horizontal towel bar, and on the right side is a horizontal towel bar. What is a towel bar antenna? The coax cable comes up to the skin of the airplane, and the shield is attached to the skin. The center conductor goes to what literally looks like the towel bar in your bathroom that's holding up your towel. It literally looks like that. At the far end of the towel bar is a 50-ohm load resistor going back into the sheet metal of the airplane. Why in the world did they do that? That antenna is extremely broadband. That antenna works from roughly 20 megacycles to, I'll pick a number, close to 800 megacycles. It covers that frequency region. The towel bar itself is probably at the highest frequency, not even a quarter wavelength long. At the lower frequencies, it's a few...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
At the lower frequencies, it's only a few percent of a wavelength long. Visual-wise, if you plot the standing wave ratio versus frequency, that antenna is a beautiful antenna. It probably has a 1.5 standing wave ratio from 20 megacycles to 800 megacycles inclusive. So as a load to a receiver or to a transmitter, it's a beautiful antenna. You plot the gain versus frequency. At the highest frequency, it probably has a little bit less than a dipole of gain. At the lowest frequency, it is 25 dB below dipole in gain because it is a slightly radiating 50-ohm resistor, if you know what I mean, a 70-ohm resistor. At first, that's sounds like a very undesirable antenna. This is a very desirable antenna. It's got a beautiful impedance match. It's got beautiful frequency bandwidth. The left-hand side tower bar antenna has a great big lobe to the left side of the aircraft. The right-hand side, one on the right-hand side of the vertical stabilizer, has a great big lobe on the right-hand side. By comparing the two, it is an interferometry dual antenna, which does beautiful direction finding. And even though the antenna at the lowest frequency has 25 dB less gain than a dipole, and it sounds very undesirable, the thing that is designed to look for is high-power radars, long-range search radars at those low frequencies. The signal you get from the radar is so potent that even though the antenna is 25 dB down, it got more than enough signal going into the antenna, into the receiver. So that particular antenna fulfills the requirement for direction finding, bandwidth, and more than enough sensitivity for that particular operation. Now, you and I, as a ham radio operator, let me drop. Most of the time, we wouldn't want to use an antenna that's 20 dB below a dipole in gain, unless you want to only talk to the guy that's, within a mile of your house, so to speak. However, it does work. And as a broadband antenna, know that it works and know that it can be used. You take that 50-ohm terminating resistor with the shortest possible lead you can assemble, put it on the end of your coax cable, put a lot of power into it from your transmitter, from your exciter in the shack, and your receiver in the shack will get a tremendous signal because it's so close. Until you put a completely shielded box around the end of that terminating resistor on the end of the cable, until you do that, you can't stop it from radiating. So from an electromagnetic interference engineer's point of view, that is a radiator. From a ham radio operator's point of view, where it only has, 1% or 3% of the RF energy going into space, we consider it a non-radiator. It's a leaky resistor. Even when you pour your transmitter into a well-shielded dummy load, your receiver in the shack is going to be bombed because the signal is so strong and so close. So the word radiation is very relative to where you're coming from and what percentages. It's all predictable, all measurable. And so the infinitesimal dipole needs super high voltages, and the resistor on the end doesn't meet that requirement. So it's not going to be an efficient radiator. It radiates, but very poorly by usual amateur standards. KC2WGB, K2RAW in the thickness.
Great information, Dick. And I'm sure Espinosa's going to have fun with that. All right. I do have a question on that. If we were to take three or four of those elements and stack them vertically, couldn't we build a collinear array out of that? Or a phased array?
Give that man a cigar. Absolutely. So now you can build a phased array antenna, vertically stacked, which will give you a very narrow pancake pattern on the horizon, very narrow in elevation. Even though each individual element has some number of negative decibels of gain compared to a dipole, maybe minus 10 dB down for your particular design, by putting enough of them together, you can get the gain back up again. So now you can build a vertically stacked antenna. And by the way, the tower bar doesn't have to be completely flat against a flat piece of sheet metal. You can put it on a cylinder. You can take a vertical cylinder of sheet metal and wrap the tower bars around the perimeter. The tower bars are going to be a kind of a hoop-like antenna where the hoop is parallel to the ground, and a vertical stack of those. You can now build a nearly omnidirectional, extremely broadband antenna with a pancake-like pattern to it, aimed at the horizon, horizontally polarized, and extremely broadband. It takes quite a bit of real estate to do it, but stack enough of them, you get the gain to come back. Now you have your cake and eat it too. You've made a big investment in hardware, but you can have as much gain as you want if you're willing to stack them high enough. I'll admit the efficiency is going to be kind of poor. I mean, each individual element, if it's got 5% efficiency, when you make a phased array of a zillion of them, you're still going to have exactly 5% efficiency because you're dividing the power with a power divider network going to the individual antennas in your phasing harness. And so whatever percentage of efficiency you get out of one, the stacked array will
programmed it beautifully. The EA-6B airplane is a good example for that particular...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So that would be a fun project, John. And it's not an ideal solution, but it's a very unusual solution that could fulfill a particular requirement you've got. You want to be able to use your scanner from DC to light, so to speak. You want to cover every possible unknown frequency to scan. You want to have the exact same amount of gain throughout the frequency region, almost, or a very predictable amount of sliding gain at 6 dB per octave, roughly. You want to have a very good standing wave ratio. You want to have omnidirectional pattern. And in this particular case, you want horizontal polarization. You can do that, KC2WGB. And write an article if you do, John, K2IW in the TechNet.
Dick, that sounds like a fun project. I might try that. Sorry to dwell on this, but one other question. Could that be set up on a bed spring array? And would there be any advantage to that? Because we have quite a few of them on there.
Yes, you could. And because they're short with reference to a wavelength, you can stack a whole lot of them in a small area. And you think because you stacked a whole lot of it in a small area, you're going to get all of the gain back. Got to be a little bit careful on this one now. Despite the fact that the tall bar antennas have a small physical area, they still have the exact same capture area of a dipole, believe it or not. The capture area is a dipole, but it's a very inefficient capture area. So you got to be careful when you use the word area. Electronically, they got the area. They're collecting the signal. But because of the short wavelength and the resistive loading thing, it's wasting the area that it has collected. As such, when you put a whole lot of them close together, they're going to be tightly coupled to each other. They're not really independent devices. And so you still need, let me pick a number, quarter wavelength of spacing between the elements in order to have the gain add up correctly. So despite the fact you've made them 10% of a wavelength long, you can't stack them 10% of a wavelength apart from each other and expect the gain to increase the way you want it to. There really would be, in that example I just gave, of 10% stacking distance on 10% of a wavelength of length, they would be so tightly coupled to each other, they wouldn't be independent devices. The gain wouldn't go up the way you want it to. You see where I'm going on that one, John? This is a slightly difficult area. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, they would not be able to use the apparent aperture. Okay, understand that. But yeah, sounds like a great project. All right, let me let it drop and I'll go to the next one. KC2WGB. Oh, this one's right into your profession, this question. Something I never thought of. Concerning radar, is there such a thing as passive radar? The gentleman is asking that if you were able to tune a broadband area, would you be able to detect radar emissions from other equipment bouncing off of, say, aircraft or ships, something like that? Has that been done? Over to you, Dick.
Boy, has that been done. Not very well known. If you go to Skolnick's Radar Handbook, great big red book, it's around $150. You could buy it brand new these days. And I don't know how many chapters it's got. If I had to make a guess, I'd say it's got about 40 chapters. There's a whole chapter on something called bistatic radar. Let me explain what that means. A conventional radar has got, let me pick a number, a megawatt transmitter. It puts out a pulse a few microseconds long, and maybe it puts out 330 pulses per second. So 330 pulse rep rate, 5 microseconds long each pulse, and each pulse is a megawatt of power. It goes into a great big bat wing antenna. It transmits a pulse. It immediately switches over to the receive mode and looks at the echo of everything that happens in the next 3.3 milliseconds in my example until the next pulse it's about to transmit. That is a so-called monostatic radar. It is transmitting and receiving from the exact same location. And in most cases, that fulfills the requirement. And when it comes to the electromagnetic and the ECM world, the electronic countermeasures world, there's all kinds of stealthing techniques of an airplane where you can make the echo of the airplane mostly disappear in the majority of the directions. Let me drop. So if you're smart enough in the way you design your airplane, you can make the monostatic echoes go to extremely small numbers. However, if your particular adversary is smart enough to set up a number of radar-like devices around the property, around your particular town, let's assume I want to protect New York City. I've got a beautiful radar located at the Brookhaven Laboratory, like there really is one there, a weather radar, an X-ray radar there, and it's lighting up the whole tri-state area and doing aircraft measurements, so to speak. And now, if I'm willing to set up a number of radar-like looking things scattered around, let me say, the perimeter of Staten Island, where those radar-like things are only listening sites, not transmitting sites, so that all of the transmission takes place from Brookhaven Laboratory, in my example, all of the aircraft flying around in the New York City area, they're giving some echoes back to Brookhaven, but they are also giving echoes to all of those other antennas scattered around the area. That is a monostatic radar. If I had only two of them, it would be called bistatic, or if I got many of them, I'll call it monostatic. There's a huge advantage of doing that. The vast majority of what you think are stealthy airplanes that have very little echo, to a monostatic radar, that's true. To a bistatic or a monostatic radar, they are not low in echo anymore. Believe it or not, if I aimed a radar at a water tower, and you would think if I got my receiving antenna directly behind the water tower 5 miles away, you would think that second antenna directly behind the water tower is in a great big shadow area. Good common sense. Assuming that antenna is sent to them in the radar manner, there's all kinds of signal crawling around the perimeter of that water.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
There's all kinds of radio signal crawling around the perimeter of that water tower. If your eyes work at RF frequencies on a dark night, and you look at that antenna that's directly behind the water tower in what you think is the shadow, you would see the perimeter of the water tower lit up with fringing radio waves, if you know what I mean. So, directly behind the water tower, there's a beautiful signal to be received out there. You can now see that your stealthy airplane that you think is not going to show up on the radar scheme is going to show up. There's a whole lot of extra science required. In other words, you now have to keep track of the fact that a pulse from the transmitting radar is going out into space, and for the antenna that's located somewhere else that's doing the receiving, the monostatic, the polystatic radar, the bistatic or polystatic radar, it has to now electronically steer its beam in order to follow the path of the original transmitting signal as it progresses in the direction toward targets. So you've got to do some fancy electronic steering on each individual pulse. That has been done. I didn't say it's easy, but once you go through all the design of this multiple location radar-like system, where maybe only one of them is transmitting and all the others are receiving, if you're willing to make the investment in the hardware to do that, you end up with one hell of a system. Now, I have done that. By that I mean, there was a beacon transmitter on 10 gigs in southern New Jersey. And as a rain cloud would proceed from Pennsylvania across northern New Jersey toward me, I could aim my 3-degree beam with antenna first at the beacon and pick up some nice loud signal. I could then steer the antenna a little bit more clockwise, more to the west. The beacon was to the southwest of me. I could steer it more to the west. Look at
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
at that rain cloud, and I was getting a beautiful echo off the rain cloud. On top of that, when I aimed to the left-hand side of the rain cloud, because the rain cloud is in a low-pressure area, and the air, by definition, is rotating in a counterclockwise manner, top view, around a low-pressure area, the water droplets on the left-hand side of the cloud are coming toward me, relativistically speaking. The water droplets on the right-hand side of the cloud, from my point of view, are receding away from me. I would hear positive Doppler shift of the CW signals at 10 gigs on the left side of the cloud. I would hear negative Doppler shift on the signals on the right-hand side of the cloud. And in between, because the cloud itself is a distributed echoing area, the beautiful pure tone coming out of that beacon transmitter started sounding like an aurora signal. It sounded like as I tuned across the thing with my receiver, if you know what I mean. I would hear a vague tone in there, but a very aurora-like tone. I was doing a bistatic radar experiment. That particular target, called rain cloud, I could figure out by the geometry where the cloud was, how far it was away from me. I could make an estimation by how fast I knew it was traveling, how soon it would take for that rainstorm to get to me, just by me passively listening to the echo off of that cloud from that beacon transmitter in southern New Jersey, 90 miles away from me. In that case, it wasn't an airplane I was looking at. It was a cloud, but I think you see the principle. And so, of the 35 different kinds of radars that John and I were discussing earlier this week, monostatic radar is very sophisticated, but it's one of them, and he's right on. And too bad it's not very well known, and he's really reinventing a wheel, if you know what I mean. But not knowing that other people have done it, there's probably brand new ways of doing it better. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the deck, man.
Again,
KC2WGB,
and I also assume you could approximate the diameter of that cloud by the angulation of your angle of your antenna sweeping from the positive Doppler shift to the negative Doppler shift. Awesome. Really great. One thing, could you elaborate a little more on how that effect happens with the antenna receiving station in the shadow receiving? How does that happen? I would think it would be totally blocked or really way down in the noise level. I don't understand how that happens.
Okay, let's get back to the way you test a radar. Every target that a radar sees is rated as to its echo power. The echo power is in RCS, radar cross-section. And the units of radar cross-section are square meters. And what does that mean? Believe it or not, if I wanted to test the sensitivity of my radar, and if my radar is known to have a particular sensitivity at 100 miles, what I literally would do, if I wanted an absolute confirmation end-to-end test, I would fly an airplane 100 miles away, I would drop a metal sphere on a parachute. The metal sphere, if I wanted to do a particular test, I could adjust the diameter of my metal sphere so that it projects an area of 1 square meter. That means that the metal sphere, which is going to be a little bit more than a meter in diameter, and I've adjusted its diameter such that it casts a shadow on the ground at high noon of exactly 1 square meter. So that metal sphere has a projected area of 1 square meter. That really tells you just about exactly how much radio, how much radar signal it intercepts on reception. Believe it or not, that 1 square meter effective area metal sphere produces an echo in all directions, 360 degrees around. I'll admit that the echo in the retro direction back toward the radar is a little bit stronger than the one in all the other directions, but that radio signal hitting the metal of that sphere creates currents that flow all the way around that sphere. The whole thing is radiating. Opposite of common sense, but that's the way radio and radar works. And so it is radiating almost the same strength of signal in
repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's radiating almost the same strength of signal in the direction that you think is the deep shadow, there ain't no shadow, with rare exception. There's some peaks and valleys, there's some fingers in space because of the way things ebb in phase, but that metallic object radiates in all directions. Your water tower is a great big version of that, and the radio signal curls around the edge. I think it's called the Keller effect, but once you set up a radio current on the skin of a conducting object, that radio signal is crawling all over that skin and re-radiating in a hell of a lot of directions. So to really make a metallic airplane stealthy in all directions, you'd be amazed how difficult it is on a modern-day sophisticated radar. So what you think is a shadow is not. As I said earlier, if your eyes operated at radio frequencies and you're standing at the location of the antenna that you think is in the shadow, on a dark day, if your eyes could light up, could see the radio waves, the perimeter of that water tower would be lit up with radio waves. Very similar to what happens to some degree if you looked at the sharp edge of a razor blade being hit with a bright light in a very dark room, and you're behind the razor blade in what you think is a shadow area, that sharp edge, you'll see it lighting up with, I can't remember the name of the effect, but the radio wave, I guess it's called the top of the mountain effect. No, it's got another name. I can't think of the name of the effect right now, but the radio wave crawls around the edges, John. So what you think is a shadow, to some degree is a shadow, but it is never a perfect shadow. The radio finds a way to get there. Once you issue a radio signal anywhere in
knife-edge diffraction,
that's the word I'm looking for, knife-edge diffraction. Once you issue a radio wave anywhere in this universe, that radio wave goes to every single cubic centimeter of this universe. The only thing left to discuss is how strong is the signal when it gets there? Is it above the threshold of the equipment you're using to receive it? It goes everywhere. Even inside of a perfect screen room that you think has got 100 decibels of shielding, you use sensitive enough radio inside that screen room, you will hear the sound of the broadcast station that is 10 miles away. Extremely weak, but it's still there. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the Tech Man.
Okay, Dick, so then I can assume, probably I assume, that if an aircraft was following parallel to the beam of the transmitter and behind this water tower, we would still be able to detect it, even though it seems to be in a shadow, supposedly. Is that correct?
And now you're describing a much more difficult condition, John. If I'm just transmitting toward the water tower, and I've got an antenna 10 miles away directly behind the water tower, he's going to get a pretty big signal. But it is attenuated. If I suddenly remove the water tower, the signal I'm going to get out there is a hell of a lot stronger. Maybe the water tower is going to give you a 25 decibel attenuation, but that's still plenty of signal. Now, if I want to see a target 10 miles directly behind the water tower, because the water tower is giving me 20 decibels, in my example, of attenuation on the outgoing signal, the signal hits the airplane, reflects, and the signal comes back toward the radar and gets another 20 dB of attenuation. If it's a real good radar, maybe you're going to see the signal. Maybe you're going to see the echo of the airplane. But you're at a huge disadvantage. I'm letting you know that the knife-edge diffraction in the signal beyond the top of the mountain and around the water tower does not go to zero. There is a signal there. But if you made the mistake of thinking from what I said that the signal is equal in amplitude, it's going to be heavily attenuated. You can never kill the signal. You can attenuate the daylights out of it. You can't kill it. Am I still going to be able to see the airplane at 100 miles behind that water tower? Hey, it's going to be a lot more difficult, as you can see. Over to you, John. K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, great information. No, okay, I understand completely. Plus, the transmitting antenna and receive is going to get a larger signal from the tower than it would from the plane. So, you know, that amount of attenuation may not be able to discern the plane. Okay, well, that's it from the mail bag, and let's go over to Paul, see what great information he's got for us tonight. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, let me give you another piece of information on that one, John. Yes, you're getting a huge echo from the water tower. And at first you think the echo from the water tower is going to overpower the weak echo from the airplane 100 miles away. Not necessarily. The water tower gives you an echo that is soon, because in the time domain it's very close. The echo from the airplane is a good number of microseconds downrange. That's a separate event. And with reasonable pulse duration on the radar, those two events are independent and don't overlap with each other. So, the fact that you're getting a big echo from the water tower isn't a showstopper. You see where I'm going on that one? It's a different time domain of the echo. Over to you, John.
Absolutely, Dick. Okay. Yep, learn more and more. More I don't you. But we had some great questions tonight, I believe. Oh, by the way, did you get the latest update on that data sheet I sent you?
Yes, I did. And what John is talking about is he owns the Hewlett-Packard brand name Power Divider Light Device. So it's kind of a Wilkinson hybrid. That's the good news. And his particular Wilkinson hybrid is rated on its cover to be operational from 10 megahertz to 1,000 megahertz inclusive. A typical Wilkinson hybrid, you know, if you built one for 700 megs, it would have reasonable performance between 500 and 1,000. But not much good performance beyond that. And his particular device is not really the conventional Wilkinson hybrid with a pair of quarter wavelength 70 ohm lines inside. This particular thing has got ferrite transformers and resistors in a particular arrangement. And I'm reasonably sure when you finally get around to removing that 19 ohm thing, the thing with 19 on it, I suspect you're going to find it's a capacitor, not a resistor. But it's a pretty fancy circuit. And my guess is brand new is like $500. And he found it brand new on eBay for $19 or something like that, and he bought a pair of them. He got a bargain. That's a fun object in his laboratory to hook it up with his signal generators, his spectrum analyzers, and his power meters. He's making some very nice measurements. If it was an ideal, perfect Wilkinson hybrid, from the common input to the two outputs, each output would be 3.1 decibels attenuated. And he measures 4.1 decibels of attenuation. So it's a little bit below ideal, but it's got huge bandwidth, and it's got reasonable isolation between the two outputs, 20 to 25 dB of isolation. So he's got a real nice item there. Okay, let's see what Paul's got to say here. What's NASA doing these days? And I think I heard something good about the Mars Surface Laboratory, Curiosity. I think it ate some dirt this week. Tell us about that, Paul. WS2N, KQLAW in the tech band.
Okay, I'm one of these days. I got to find out what that piece of equipment is. When you go to QIZ for John's call, the first piece of equipment is the Hewlett-Packard thing. I got to find out what that is, John, one of these days. Interesting piece of equipment. Got a big tube on there. And I don't know if I can split you out of it. Being shown. I don't know. Is that the thing that you were talking about, Dick? The Hewlett-Packard thing?
John's most recent measurements are a object that is in the vicinity of 4 inches square, probably an inch high, 3/4 of an inch high. It's a 3-terminal device, 3 type N connectors on it. And it's a quasi-Wilkinson hybrid. It's a little package that he's testing. When you go to his website and you look at his beautiful laboratory, you'll see a zillion dollars worth of test equipment, all kinds of signal generators and frequency counters and spectrum analyzers and whatever. No, I don't think this thing, although he's taken some beautiful pictures of it, I don't think it's on his website yet. Let's let John tell us about that. Over to you, John, KQLAW.
Very good, Dick. Paul, that first picture, that's the vector network analyzer. That's an HP also. The Wilkinson-type copper divider, I don't have that on the website, but I will probably tomorrow, and you'll be able to look at that. It's a little device. And by the way, Dick, it was inches by 3/4 of an inch. It's a very compact little device.
That's a fun toy. What he's got is one of the things that when you and I go to a flea market, Paul, the average guy ignores them. You see all of these beautiful Nodder directional couplers that cost $500 a piece sitting on the table at these flea markets. The guy is selling them for $10, $15. Everybody turns up their nose because they don't know what it is. Once you learn what a good directional coupler is or a power divider, there's lots of ways you can be using it, even way beyond the frequencies it's rated for. You see a Nodder directional coupler that's made for 500 to 1,000 megs, or made between 8 and 12 gigahertz. You'll be amazed how useful that thing is at 6 meters, 2 meters, 432, and to some degree it's even useful on 80 to 10 meters, opposite of common sense. And so if you go to a particular website where I've written an article on that, you can read exactly what I'm talking about. You go to K5RMG, K5RomeoMikeGolf.org. RMG stands for Roadrunners Microwave Group, K5RMG.org. You go there, and you click on Technical Information. You go to the bottom of the page, and you'll find the K2RIW Technical Corner, and you go to the article on directional coupler, and you start reading. And you'll be amazed how useful those very inexpensive things are. Over to you, Paul, and tell us about the dirt that Curiosity just ate. WS2N, K2RIW, the big man.
Okay, and John, thanks for still on the network analyzer. Nice piece of equipment. Didn't know what it was, but now I do. The Curiosity, doing good. Glen Lake is the area they're going to next. Let me get there. It takes a long time to go a couple of thousand feet to get there, but that's the next goal. But they're probably about 3/4 of the way to their next goal where they'll probably spend another month at that site. But they need to test the SAM, the sample analyzer at Mars, they call it. That's the body of the Curiosity rover. And this is the thing that really tests for minerals and organics and what could possibly be in the soil or even rock sample that they put in into the body of Curiosity. So, yeah, they finally decided on putting this one sample in. They were going to use another sample, but they got rid of it because they saw something shiny in there. They thought maybe that was part of the rover that fell off. It turns out it looks like they think it was a piece of plastic. Let me drop it. Didn't want to contaminate the inside with something from Earth. So they dumped that, and then now they found another sample because there's some shiny material in the dirt, and they want to know what this is. So they're going to put it in, and when they have put it in, now they're going to test it, analyze it, and they'll get an answer of what they're exactly looking for. And you can do this thing dozens and dozens of times. You can make tests